Hello, this is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and welcome to Rolling Stone. In this edition of Rolling Stone, we wrap up reading from the November 2025 edition of Rolling Stone magazine. And we continue to read from Random Notes, and it's the Q&A, NAS. Artists, in a sense, are superheroes. They lift people up. The rap icon has always made sure hip-hop gets its due. His new project, a series of albums and comic books, continues that mission. Since debuting in 1991 with a feature on Main Source's Live at the Barbecue, Nas has been intent on amplifying New York hip-hop. His first full-length album, Illmatic, was an evolution in hip-hop lyricism, and his top-tier penmanship has powered a catalog of 17 solo albums. He's always paid respect to pioneers, with hits like 2007's Where Are They Now and 80s Remix, allowing trailblazers such as Kool Moe Dee, Shane, and Dana Dune to tell their stories. Nas has a new project aimed at honoring more hip-hop legends. Alongside the label Mass Appeal, Nas is dropping the Legend Has It album series, which includes releases from rap heavyweights Slick Rick, Rak One, and Ghostface Killian and Moeb Deep. A posthumous record from Big L is expected later this fall, with music from De La Soul, as well as a joint DJ premiere and Nas project on the horizon. As Nas says, you would think that sound was a sound that you no longer hear again, but that sound lives in all hip-hop music. Mass Appeal has also partnered with Marvel on a, Legend Has It, comic, immortalizing the acts in the series as superheroes. The first issue, written by Brandon Thomas and drawn by Samford Green, debuted on Comic-Con in October with more issues to follow. As Nas says, every artist that's on this Marvel cover was once comic book fans. So for all of us, it's one of the coolest things. And now the interview. Question: what does it mean to be able to amplify your peers and predecessors with this series? Nas: in hip-hop music, you got different age groups, different cities, countries that have their own section of hip-hop all over the world. It's finally become a global thing. And when I was a kid, is hip-hop global, was the question. It is just a New York to LA thing? Is it just America or just London? Some of the grown-ups didn't understand it or believe it would last. Not only did it last, it became a worldwide thing. So to play any part in it today, this year, 2025, is a dream come true. Question: how did the Mass Appeal and Marvel comic books happen? Nas: there's another thing I think we just manifested being fans of Marvel, which has been a part of my life since I don't even know when. It kind of speaks to the writer in me who would read these things and it would spark my imagination. And I would draw my own comic books and color and create the stories. I had a name. I can't remember the name of my company. I was probably 9 years old, maybe 10 years old. Question: do you have a favorite Marvel character growing up? Nas: Wolverine, Iron Man. That's Ghostface right there all day long. Spider-Man, Magneto, the Hulk. Question: what are some of the similarities in the way that comic book creators and rappers create worlds? Nas: artists, in a sense, are superheroes because they help get people through tough times. They lift people up. It's the music in the gym when people are becoming superheroes, so to speak. I had a song called Superhero Status, and it's just about everybody has a superhero in them. They have to tap into it, reach that level of positivity. Question: what do you think the Legend Has It series conveys about the classic New York sound? Nas: it's 1995 all over again. Sometimes I feel like 2025 has that feeling, It's not going backwards. It's going forward, though. It's that feeling of urgency, that vibration, the celebration of life. And these songs and these albums, what they meant 30 years ago, it's still thriving right now. Even from younger people, they're all derivatives of that early sound. And these artists here, from Slick Rick, he is a reason that all of us even have a pen in our hands. You look at him and you think of Mobb Deep, and you think of Raekwon and Ghostface. Question, could you speak to De La Soul's legacy and their upcoming project? Naz, these dudes from Long Island had a different perspective, almost hippies in hip-hop. The hardest dude on the street was blown away by De La Soul because their expression gave us multiple colors through music. They had something that spoke to us the first time we ever saw television or heard music. It was all wrapped in the imagination of Poseidonis and Moscow and Dave. Question, what do you remember about the Godfellows crew with Biggie in the early 90s? Were there any plans to drop music as a duo? Naz, we didn't get that far. It was just like, yo, let's go with this. So life took us into different things. I went where I went. He went all the way with Bad Boy, and he built up what he built up. So we were definitely talking about it, but we never got to follow through. The wind just grabbed us, and it was over. We was ghosts going in separate directions. And the final question. Your 2006 song, Hip Hop is Dead, critiqued your era's hip hop ecosystem like Kendrick Lamar's Watch the Party Die did more recently. What overlap do you see? Naz, we all as artists love this art form and have our opinions on it. Kendrick is one of the biggest stars we've ever seen, and I don't only mean superstar, I mean like the North Star. I think he's one of those. Out of all the artists in this business, there's some that's not here for the art. When we see those people that are not here for the art damaging it, you're hurting the future of the art. So I think artists like Kendrick are going to speak out. And we continue reading Musicians on Musicians, Conversations Between Musicians. In previous editions this month, we heard conversations between Jack Antonoff and Haley Williams, and last week, Cyndi Lauper and Gracie Abrams. Today, we read about Janelle Monáe and her conversation with Lucy Dacus. Two artists with expansive visions talk about gender, faith, futurism, and why some records feel like movies. Sunlight is spilling through the wide windows at Wonderland West, Janelle Monáe's rustic creative campus tucked in the hills above Hollywood, when Lucy Dacus takes her place on the set. The two artists, in matching navy Tom Brown blazers, are sitting across from each other in worn leather armchairs, poring over the notes they've written down for today's conversation with each other. They are so focused that neither one has noticed the room has fallen silent until the gentle hum of Dacus's song Ankles from her 2025 album Forever is a Feeling flutters through the air. Dacus turns pink as she hears her own music and decides to break the silence. She leans forward, eyes lit with curiosity. She asks, "Who's on your phone screen?" Janelle Monáe lifts her phone slowly, almost reverently. The lock screen glows with a black and white portrait of a smoky-eyed prince. "It's been this for 6 or 7 years now. I don't know if I can ever change it," Monáe says, bringing the phone closer to their heart. It's a quiet moment, but a revealing one. Both artists know what it means to hold on to something beloved, an influence, a feeling, a world of her own making. Monáe with shimmering sci-fi song cycles and Afro-futurist alter egos has long built expansive universes in which queer black liberation isn't a fantasy, it's the foundation. And Dacus with slow-burning lyricism and diary fragment songwriting constructs entire emotional geographies connected by faith, heartbreak, memory, and grief. For more than an hour, they discuss fear, invention, and the pleasure of letting go in an intimate conversation that is braided with reverence and reticence. They talk as if they've met before, maybe not in this life, but in some shared frequency. But first, Monet wants to know more about the opening line from Dacus' breakthrough song, Night Shift, from her 2018 LP, Historian. And now the conversation between the two. Monet, the first time I tasted somebody else's spit, I had a coughing fit. What do you mean by that? Dacus, you're hoping that something is going to be amazing, and then you get into it and you're like, this sucks. There's no chemistry. There's no magic. Disappointing. Monet, it's one of the best openings of any song that I can think of right now. Dacus, a lot of the times when I'm writing, it's just what happened. Life is poetic. It's just the noticing part. I feel like that must be true for you too. Do you feel like you romanticize or poeticize things? How often are you taking from your life to a song? Monet, I do what is best for the protagonist of the album. I see the movie. I see the scene. I see the world. I see what they're wearing. I know what kind of jam they like on their toast. I'm creating this movie in my head, or this scene that I'm dropping into song, and I write a mix of my real experiences with this future version of myself, or this version of a friend or a lover or a family member that I'm creating. I look at lyrics as downloads. Sometimes I don't know what things truly mean, the significance of them, after it's out into the world. Dacus, do you ever feel like your own listener? You hear it later and you relate to it how anyone else would? Monet, yes, that's why I loved Historian. I love what you had to say about you being an historian of all the moments. If you don't write it down or take documentation of it, people won't know. I think very similarly where I can become a patron of my own film. I'm going to go watch the movie just like you guys are, and we're discovering the same things together. Dacus, I saw your vinyl collection. There's so much classical music. As a kid, I always thought classical music was lame. Like, that's odd. But then growing up and realizing this is still some of the most inventive, robust music in the world. There's worlds built in classical music without anything other than sound. I hear it in your music so much. Monet, I actually did not listen to a lot of classical music growing up. I didn't start to discover Mahlerix and Bach. I got into more scoring and orchestration because of my love of film. When I was deciding what kind of artist I wanted to be, I would listen to a lot of instrumentals. I would listen to the instrumentation of Blade Runner. Dacus, do you do research a lot when you're making music, or do you just go in? Monet, so, The Age of Pleasure, for instance, my last album, I really studied my community and my tribe, my fam. When we would go out and party, I was like, what are we listening to? What are we all unanimously on? What vibe, what frequency are we on? And I wanted to make an album just for us. What does it feel like when Janelle Monae feels safe? What does it feel like when the people around her feel safe? Black and brown folks, queer folks, when we're not centering chaos, when we're not centering those who don't want to see us smiling and having a good time. What does that look like? What does that sound like? Dacus, you talk about your sexuality and your gender. It just seems to expand over time. You've now expanded to the point of being everything. Monet, I see the same thing with you, especially with this latest project, which I love. I love the video for Ankles. Dacus, ah, that was so much fun. Monet, you in the dress. First of all, you look so beautiful. But I love this character. I feel like I want to see this character come out in some long-form way. Dacus, so you own these parts of yourself, whereas I don't know if I have them. I have to do them to see acting or other types of writing. Monet, but wait, you studied film. Dacus, yeah, I do feel like that is who I am, and music is this weird side road that happened. Monet, that is so weird. Are we the same? Dacus, well, you're a director. You're like an auteur. Monet, I've not finished writing my thing. I'm in the middle of writing it right now. Dacus, a screenplay? You don't need to talk about it, but I want to know. Monet, well, yeah, I'm writing a screenplay right now. Dacus, that's so sick. Monet, the goal has always been to write, star, do the soundtrack, produce, a lot of things, I know, but I have to fully realize an idea, and I know that I will not stop until I get this. I wish I had some sort of pipe that I can push into my brain, because the time that it takes, you have the idea, and to realize it, you got to talk to all these people. I'm just like, I see it. Dacus, with film, there's so many other people. Monet, so many filters, yeah. Dacus, that's the thing. I was like, man, if I keep doing film, I'm going to have to talk to rich people so much. I'm going to have to convince them they're going to make money on me. I felt so demoralized. I'm going to hate myself if I contribute to work that I think is bad for the world. Monet, yeah. But I see it in your music videos. I see the tiny nuances. I follow a character. I'm in the world that you built. Even in Ankles, I was like, this makes so much sense. And even how you use words, it's cinematic. And that's a filmmaker. Dacus, thanks. An album to me, what makes you not turn it off is thinking about it as a progression through scenes. You have to earn the end of the record. So often my favorite songs are towards the end of the record because it's like you set up the question and go on the quest and then you arrive at something. Do you ever think about that? Because you have such scenes, actual vibrant settings that you move through. How do you track stuff? Monet, I don't lock into making an album unless I know what I want to how to start it, the acts within it, and how it's going to end. I need to know the hero's journey. Dacus, uh-huh. Monet, I need to know the turning point, the call to action, all the things. And I need to get out of the messiness of who this person is so you can feel the transformation of them. And once I lock into that, all the songs just flow. Now, sometimes things are not resolved, and it's a to be continued. Dacus, such is life. Monet, yeah, that's life. Everything does not always pan out. I need to know that, though, before I start mapping. Dacus, my first girlfriend in college was like, we're sitting down and you're watching these music videos. I remember watching your music video for Queen with Erykah Badu. It's the best music video to me. I show it to all of my friends. I just love that you're your own guest rapper. The reveal, you're setting up for a feature, and then you feature yourself. It's amazing. Monet, wow, I'm blushing. I was reading Ray Kurzweil's The Singularity Is Near before we wrote any music for my first album, which was 2010's The Ark Android. That was talking about the Turing test and how when AI can trick you into believing that you're talking to your mother and you're not, that is when the singularity is going to happen and where we are right now today. The fact that we can talk to a chatbot. You cannot distinguish what is a human voice from AI. It's just mind-blowing how technology moves at this exponential rate. Dacus, I wanted to ask you about that because 15 years ago, you have this android life that you're bringing so much heart to. And now it feels closer than ever that androids are actually going to enter our sphere. Monet, yeah, they're here. Dacus, I don't know. At least for me, I'm very freaked out. I'm not for it. AI seems like an easy way for people to get out of the dirt and grime of having to coexist, when actually it's through the hardness of being with each other that we find the peace and the comfortableness. Part of being comfortable is maybe testing that it's not just happiness all the time. It's getting through disagreements and hardships. Monet, in real life. Dacus, yeah, it's like you're tearing the little muscles so they get stronger. Monet, that's a good song lyric. You're tearing the little muscles to get stronger. Dacus, take it. Monet, I love that, but I feel you, and I'm scared too. I'm also hopeful that we will realize, as we have throughout history, that we need each other in real life as well. Whatever we can do to get our feet in the sand and really connect, I think that will benefit us all long term. Dacus, yeah. Monet, I think that our mental health will become much better because isolation, too much of it. I'm an introvert. How about you? Dacus, I'm more of an introvert as time goes on. I've always been a host. Sounds like you throw parties. Monet, I do. Dacus, I used to before I moved here. This is the most introverted I've ever been living in L.A. I'm from Virginia, and I lived in Philly for a while. The houses I lived in were like show houses. I'd come home, and someone would be having their birthday party who didn't even live there. Monet, for a long time, I grew up Baptist. Where'd you grow up? Dacus, Baptist also. Monet, I grew up in church. We could not show skin. There are a lot of women in our family who were violated, so they would say, cover up, as a way to protect yourself from men being attracted to you. And I had to unlearn that. My freedom is important. My bodily autonomy is important. And my freedom cannot be choked so that you cannot have urges to want to rape me or molest me or violate my body. Dacus, it's not on you. Monet, that's not my problem. That's something you need to control. Dacus, that's a sickness on the other side. Monet, do not ask me to choke my freedom to make you comfortable. I spent a lot of time unlearning that and also pushing my boobies down because it was something that I was made to feel more ashamed of versus confident within and in celebrate of. Dacus, now your tits out on the album cover. Monet, I guess I'm making up for lost time. I don't know. But I'm also just honoring my body and saying, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I didn't know that it wasn't my fault. Dacus, that's so powerful. Monet, talk me through some of the things that you had to tell yourself too. Because like me, we both can do tuxedos and suits in our Tom Brown, be fully clothed and comfortable. I feel sexy in a suit. I feel sexy in a birthday suit. What was going through your mind when you were visually thinking of the iconography for your look? Were you scared? Dacus, for being more mask? Monet, for just going between. I say water and rock, soft and hard. Being non-binary, I think of it in energy. Dacus, I feel this deeply. If I was ever told you have to be one way forever, I would be like, maybe life's not for me. It's very important every day to wake up and be like, is it a boy day or a girl day? Or on tour, especially if we do two nights in the same city. I'll have boy night, girl night. In the ankles video, I have this big gown, and that obviously feels like a costume because it is one. But whenever I'm doing a really feminine look, I feel like I'm putting on a costume, but for fun. And then I feel myself in more traditionally masculine clothes. But I want both. I want it all. Monet, and you have it all. Dacus, I don't think you need to choose, even if the words don't follow. For some people, it's really important to find the words, and for me, it's more important to find the inhabiting. That took a while. As you're saying, growing up Baptist, I didn't grow up with a ton of examples of people who I would describe as free. If I ever saw one out of the corner of my eye, they'd be vilified. Or not even just vilified, but made fun of. And you're like, I don't want to be a para. I'll keep in my lane. Monet, I was with a friend and we played this game. There are four energies in the car. One is fear. One is ego. One is spirit. One is sexuality. Who's driving? Who's riding shotgun? And which two are in the back seat? Dacus. Fear has got to get to the back seat, but it's so often driving. Or maybe passenger princess is fear. I think when you love your life, fear comes in. The more I love my life, the more I feel I have things to lose. forever as a feeling is a lot about falling in and out of love and having love just wreck your psyche. It changes your life whether you're ready for it or not. And it's just this preemptive feeling of loss. And I also did want to make some happy songs. I think they're important. I want to get old and hear that I felt this way. That's the other thing. I'm thinking about time constantly, and I'm weirdly always thinking about my deathbed and how I want for everything I made to have made me proud. I just want a document, like Historian, my album, of having felt this way, because I want to remember what it was like. Monet, I love that. One of my biggest fears is not really my transitioning out of here, but the people I love. Because that's my biggest fear, people that I love leaving without peace. Monet, yeah, it's something I don't think anybody ever gets used to. Dacus, for lyric writing, I'll think out albums 5, 6, 7. Every year I have a thing on my phone called Various Bits, 2023, 24, 25, every lyric idea I put in there. Monet, that's so smart. See, mine is song concepts. This was so magical and wonderful and so peacefully inspiring and creatively fulfilling to be in your presence and talking with you and being able to just tell you in person how much I love you. Dacus, I can't believe you're saying this to me. That's what's crazy. I've been a fan for so long. Please keep making great music. You don't have to, but it seems like you have a lot of plans. Monet, I feel like we're supposed to make movies too, and we will. I'm speaking that into the future. Dacus, it's supposed to happen. Monet, as a futurist. Dacus, I really am excited for you. Monet, I can't wait till you do your first movie. I see it. You can do it all, and you will. Dacus, I really want to. And that ends the conversation. We leave musicians on musicians and turn to the feature article, The Crypto Kingpin of Bel Air. Adam Eiza was a teen prodigy in the world of cryptocurrency, but when he fell in with notorious hackers, authorities say his business turned criminal. For a private detective working in Los Angeles, most investigations tend to follow a predictable pattern. You get a divorce case or a custody case, and from the time the client pays the retainer, you know what the job will entail. You follow a guy around, taking pictures from hotel parking lots or outside of a club on Sunset, trying to prove he's having an affair. Or maybe it's a workers' comp case, same thing. You tail a guy, take pictures, prove he's not really hurt. But the Adam Eiza case, it was different from the start. Eiza was a computer whiz who'd made millions off crypto. He had called Paramount Investigative Services in November 2021 with what seemed like a straightforward investigative job. He was hoping to recover a stolen laptop with $300 million in crypto on it and had a good idea who had taken it. Paramount's founder, Ken Childs, didn't know a whole lot about crypto, but promised Eiza he could track down the laptop. He warned it could take a while, though. The guy who stole it probably didn't want to be found. After a few weeks of surveilling the suspected thief and turning up no solid leads, Childs decided he wanted to meet Eiza. The crypto world was full of con artists, and Childs was keen to make sure Eiza was who he said he was, a kid in his 20s worth $700 million. This job was going to get expensive. Childs asked Eiza for his address and headed to Bel Air. When he pulled up to Eiza's house in Bel Air, he couldn't see past the towering hedges and big redwoods circling the property. He texted Eiza to say he had arrived, and a security guard dressed in all black emerged. He stood about 6'4" and wore an earpiece. The guard opened a wrought iron gate, and Childs drove onto a horseshoe-shaped driveway past a blacked-out Crown Vic, which he figured belonged to security. The house had been built in 1927 in a Mediterranean style, all white, with a red tile roof. But just a few years before, an architect who had done work for Rod Stewart and Sylvester Stallone had gutted the interior and updated it with Italian marble floors and cathedral ceilings. Prince once lived there. Archaeological Digest called it one of the finest homes in Bel Air. Isa emerged from its arching French front doors as Childs exited his car. He was wearing a black turtleneck and black pants. He looked like he was right out of the Matrix, Child recalls. Suddenly the gate opened again and a black Rolls-Royce Phantom pulled up. Another security guard opened the door and a petite Filipino woman emerged in dark sunglasses. Two small children scurried out behind her. Her name was Iris Ah, and she was Isa's girlfriend. Childs would learn later of that fact. On Instagram, she called herself the goddess and tended to post selfies in places like Dubai or on the steps of a private jet or on a horse. She didn't look up or say anything to Childs or anyone else. Instead, she headed towards the back entrance of the 36,000 square foot mansion with her children and disappeared. Isa invited the investigator Childs inside. I just remember thinking like, holy fuck, Childs says. It's such a bizarre, massive-ass house. I was impressed and rolling my eyes at the same time. The home had a staff entrance, three elevators, and a separate pool house with an indoor pool designed to look like a Turkish bath, complete with a sauna and steam shower, a bowling alley, an indoor racquetball court, and a 700-bottle wine wall. Rent was roughly $200,000 a month. I was kind of waiting for that dude in the Old Spice commercial who's half man and half horse to come jogging through the center entry, Child says. You would have thought some kids designed the place. Isa led Childs to his office, which was trimmed in heavy oak. As they discussed the likely hurdles of the laptop recovery job, Isa said he didn't care how long it would take, 6 months, 9 months, a year. Childs offered to charge him $100 an hour, a discount from his typical $150 an hour fee. Isa assured him he had the money. Childs left Bel Air that day with few concerns about Isa's ability to pay. Before long, though, he began to feel a little uneasy, like something didn't quite add up. In May 2022, the FBI called Childs out of the blue and told them they wanted to meet. Once the FBI started asking questions, I began to wonder what I'd become a part of, Childs said. I felt like eyes were on me. But the FBI wasn't interested in Childs. Their target was Isa. Last September, federal prosecutors in the Central District of California charged Isa with tax evasion and wire fraud, alleging the man they dubbed the crypto godfather ran what amounted to a criminal conspiracy, complete with police officers on his payroll who allegedly intimidated rivals and helped enforce extortion schemes. For years, I've been warning people that this disorganized crime space was tending towards organized crime, says Allison Nixon, the chief research officer of Unit 221B, a collective of cybersecurity experts. Every subsequent year, there was some kind of new development or new level of organizational sophistication with these guys. When Isa was arrested by the FBI last September, Nixon immediately recognized the name. She had been tracking him for 2 years, and his relationship with senior members of what's called the COM, or the community, one of the most dangerous criminal hacking groups operating in the U.S. The charges against Isa suggest cybercrime has entered a new phase, says Allison Nixon. It's hard for people to wrap their heads around this because they have a certain image of organized crime and they have a certain image of cybercrime, Nixon says. But maybe the best way to think of the Adam Isa case is a convergence of those two things. Riding that unchecked wave of growth in crypto took Isa from a quiet, solitary childhood in the Midwest suburbs to a world of outlandish wealth, shady operators, and mind-boggling schemes. It was like the Great Gatsby, a friend of Isa says. He was living this amazing life, and everyone wanted a piece. But at the same time, he wondered if it was real and how long could it go on. Until very recently, local police agencies, including sprawling departments like the LAPD and the NYPD, didn't take online financial crimes or the loose collection of hackers who perpetuate them all that seriously. That's partially because they didn't understand the technology, partly because they weren't equipped to build those kinds of cases, and partly because they didn't see the stereotypical hacker, think antisocial incel, doxing Dana White or swatting a Papa John's as all that dangerous. But in the past few years, something has dramatically shifted. Crypto crimes, once contained to online harassment, now often included kidnapping, extortion, and armed threats. In May, a crypto investor was allegedly held hostage and tortured in a luxury Manhattan townhouse in what police say was a failed attempt to steal his $30 million crypto fortune. That same month, a gang in Paris attempted to kidnap the daughter and grandson of the chief executive officer of a crypto firm in broad daylight. These are not isolated incidences, but rather part of a global trend. In the past 2 years alone, there were kidnappings for ransom of cryptocurrency moguls in Toronto, Sydney, and Danbury, Connecticut. Over the same period, crypto crime has exploded. In 2023 alone, the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center received more than 69,000 reports of crypto-related financial fraud. And while crypto made up just 10% of the financial fraud cases the FBI investigated last year, it accounted for nearly half of all reported losses, $5.6 billion. All of the things people love about crypto, its decentralized nature, the ability to move digital coins around the world in an instant, the fact that all transactions are tracked in real time, make it a magnet for criminals. Because every crypto payment is locked into the blockchain's permanent ledger, in most cases, there's no way to reverse them. And unlike banks or credit card companies, there's no central authority or customer service department with the power to cancel or undo a payment, meaning it's nearly impossible to recover what's lost. Clearance rates for crypto crimes are also abysmal, Allison Nixon says. Law enforcement only has resources to focus on the biggest cases, meaning the best hackers can operate for years without facing any kind of legal repercussions. Of those who do face consequences, Nixon says, once these people get out from their very short sentences, they go right back to their gangs and then educate the rest of the members how the justice system works and how they got caught, so they can learn how not to get caught again. She adds, their careers are marked by this constant upward progression of severity and dollar amount. ISIS's path into this world was circuitous. Born Ahmed Faig in Iraq in 2000, he came to the U.S. with his family in 2011, the same year that American military officially withdrew from the country. They settled in St. Louis. While ISIS's family wasn't particularly religious, he was Muslim in an area that was mostly white and Christian. His best friend from the time, Adam Fala, says Isa had few friends and mostly kept to himself. He seemed to enjoy solitude, Isa's sister tells me. Even before he was in high school, Isa had found a passion, his mother says, computers. Fala remembers coming over to the cramped home where Isa lived with his parents and four younger siblings, and Isa showing him the computer he had built. He kept it on his bed because his room was too small for a table. It had all these wires sticking out of it, Fala remembers, but it worked. Isa was into Bitcoin and already cashing in. One day he showed up to high school driving a Porsche Boxster, Fala recalls. He started wearing Louis Vuitton and Gucci. He would walk into class and people would be like, who is this guy? Fala says. They thought he was some rich kid with rich parents because no one knew what Bitcoin was. He was mysterious. When Isa was 17, he moved to California and within a couple of years had changed his name. To Fala, he seemed like he had simply disappeared. How and why Issa moved to Los Angeles is a bit murky, as is descent into criminality. When I talked to his friends from that time period, they seemed reluctant to say too much. But several sources who know Issa well told me, on condition of anonymity, that while living in Missouri, he had become friendly with members of the COM, the Underground Hacker Collective, and that prominent members of the organization had been so impressed by crypto mining software Issa had built that they sponsored his move out to LA. Issa denies ever being part of the COM. According to Issa's friend, Millard Sorari, a cybersecurity expert who goes by the name Hackistan, it was during this time that Issa became friendly with some of the most notorious hackers on the planet. They belong to a group called UGNazi, which stands for Underground Nazi Hacktivist Group. The collective had several members, but its three most famous were known for the gods: Mir Islam, Josh the God, Troy Woody, Osama the God, and Eric Taylor, Cosmo the God. The trio had rocketed to fame in the hacker underworld circa 2011 when they doxed Kim Kardashian, Donald Trump, and Jay-Z and published the addresses, social security numbers, and other personal information of then First Lady Michelle Obama, the director of the FBI, and the U.S. Attorney General. UGNazi were most famous, however, for stealing thousands of credit card numbers, which eventually culminated in a massive FBI investigation known as Operation Card Shop. Adam got involved with the wrong group of people, a source close to Issa says. They were all older than him, and I think he was a bit lost, looking for like a big brother or a father type figure. These were people who could play on that and manipulate him. It set him off on the wrong path. A few years after graduating high school, Issa called Fala and invited him to come out to L.A. Issa told his friend he was doing very well. Fala agreed to travel out to California and work for Issa. His arrival wowed him. A security guard picked him up at LAX and drove him to Issa's mansion in Bel Air. At first, Fala didn't even recognize his old friend, who was wearing a black Tom Ford suit. He had completely transformed himself from the shy, halting boy who preferred spending time alone in his bedroom. He looked like a model, like everything was different, Fala recalls. I remember telling him, "Damn, dude, you look like Tom Cruise." Issa told Fala he was making most of his money off crypto, or more specifically, a crypto trading platform that he had invented called Zort. Using a proprietary form of AI that Issa said he developed, the Zort trading bot deployed signaling technology that analyzed news reports, market trends, and social media sentiment relating to all of the crypto exchanges around the world to make trades. Issa appeared to make more money than he knew what to do with. They would show up at a steakhouse in Beverly Hills, and the whole staff seemed to know Issa. They went to dinner with rappers, and Issa picked up the bill. They would go to a mall and a luxury store that would shut down for Issa and his crew. Anytime we'd go to a restaurant, there would be like an entourage of security, SUVs, just a whole show, says a friend from the time who is still close to Issa. And everyone's like, "Who's that?" He liked to put on a show. He also gave plenty of money away. Sometimes Sorari says they'd go down to Skid Row and I would hand out $100 bills. He supported animal rescue operations, too. And he was in love. Iris Ah, who lived with Issa for a few years, and according to Sorari, he was helping raise her two children from a previous marriage. To Fala, it seemed like a lot to juggle, but he says Issa seemed content with the way his life had turned out. In the summer of 2021, Issa began planning for his 21st birthday celebration. He wanted a party that would match the grandeur of his Bel Air home, something that people would never forget. A friend put him in touch with a party planner who had supposedly arranged events for Justin Bieber. The party planner, who was identified in court documents as Ryan Chappelle, agreed to do the job, and a few days before the event, Issa wired him $50,000 to cover expenses and services. To Issa's friends who attended the party, it seemed like a huge success. They remember seeing rappers like Akon and Gashi there, as well as models and influencers. But Iza wasn't happy. Per a source close to Iza, to increase attendance, Chappelle had invited patrons from a nearby bar who had arrived drunk and trashed the bar area of the mansion, urinating and defecating on the marble floors. 2 days after the party, Iza summoned the party planner to his home. Once inside, Chappelle was separated from a colleague he brought along and led into a home office where he sat behind a desk with a black handgun in front of him and an AR-15 nearby. Visibly agitated, Iza loaded bullets into a magazine while several bodyguards, some wearing law enforcement-style badges, stood watch. Several of the bodyguards, court documents say, were deputies from the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. That department has a troubled history. The largest sheriff's agency in the U.S., it was for years been described by watchdogs and former cops as corrupt, with an entrenched culture of lawless groups operating within its ranks. These internal cliques, or deputy gangs, have been tied to specific LASD precincts, have names like the Bandidos, the Grim Reapers, and the Regulators. In 2019, 8 LASD deputies sued the county, alleging that the Bandidos functioned like a prison gang, complete with shot callers who determined who worked which shifts, who got overtime, and who got promotions. Those in the gang were marked by a distinctive tattoo, a skeleton with a mustache wearing a sombrero and a bandolier. Getting into the gang, or chasing ink, typically required engaging in violence against civilians that skirted the law or was obviously illegal, like beating a suspect during an arrest. If you get in a shooting, that's a definite brownie point, a whistleblower told CBS News. As Rolling Stone detailed back in 2021, that year, nearly 1 in 6 LA Sheriff Department deputies surveyed said they had been invited to join an illicit subgroup. Iza's head of security, a Los Angeles Sheriff Department deputy named Eric Saavedra, had belonged to a clique known as the Jump Out Boys, according to court records. The clique encouraged violent policing, even rewarding members when they were involved in shootings, per a lawsuit against members of the clique. Iza would brag to friends in text messages over Telegram, later seized by the FBI, that he could get his security detail to do whatever he asked of them, which included illegal activity. Seated in the office of his mansion, Iza told Chappelle he wanted half of his money back because the party hadn't lived up to his expectations. Iza demanded Chappelle return half his fee and asked him to hand over his phone. At one point, Chappelle says in a lawsuit, 9 Los Angeles Sheriff Department deputies who were part of Iza's security detail drew their weapons. Chappelle relented, turning over his phone and divulging his passcode. Iza then transferred $25,000 from the party planner's bank account, photographed his passport, driver's license, and credit cards, and told him to leave the mansion. Chappelle's problems escalated from there. Federal investigators have alleged Iza began communicating with Chappelle's girlfriend and related to Saavedra that the party planner was a drug dealer. Saavedra allegedly passed this information on to a fellow LASD deputy without disclosing where it had come from or that he and his team of deputies were on Iza's payroll. In late September 2021, Iza paid Chappelle's girlfriend to fly the party planner back to LA and supplied her with cash to buy drugs, prosecutors allege. A few days later, deputies pulled over the car Chappelle was riding in for what they said was a traffic violation. After claiming Chappelle had an outstanding warrant, they searched the car and found cocaine under his seat and mushrooms in his backpack, which his girlfriend had planted at Iza's direction, federal prosecutors allege. Iza and Saavedra watched the arrest from nearby and allegedly took photos of the scene. For a drug dealer, you fucked with the wrong people, Isa texts Chappelle a few days later, along with a photo of the arrest in progress. The next day, after Chappelle texted his girlfriend, accusing her of setting him up, Isa followed with another message. The cops had you on their watch list for weeks, so go complain to them about setting you up. Ha ha ha, worthless loser. Later that month, court records allege Isa held another associate, identified in court records only as L.A., at gunpoint inside his Bel Air mansion, while off-duty LASD deputy Michael Kohlberg stood by. Accusing L.A. of scamming him, Isa threatened to hurt the man unless he paid up. The victim transferred $127,000 to Isa the same day. The next day, Deputy Kohlberg picked up L.A. at his hotel and again transported him to Isa's residence, leaving him alone with Isa at the home's shooting range, according to court records. Isa held L.A. at gunpoint. Kohlberg would later state in a plea agreement and demanded L.A.'s business partner transfer money to him, which he did later that day. Cybersecurity experts who had been tracking the comm had never seen anything like this. Doxing a judge or calling in a bomb threat, that was one thing. But hiring off-duty cops to intimidate and extort victims or throw them in jail represented a significant escalation. Isa had just crossed a line, and eventually it would bring him down. The next day, Deputy Kohlberg picked up L.A. at his hotel and again transferred him to Isa's residence, leaving him alone with Isa at the home's shooting range, according to court records. Isa held L.A. at gunpoint, Kohlberg would later state in a plea agreement, and demanded that L.A.'s business partner transfer money to him, which he did later that day. Cybersecurity experts had never been tracking the comm, had never seen anything like this. Doxing a judge or calling in a bomb threat, that was one thing. But hiring off-duty cops to intimidate and extort victims or throw them in jail represented a significant escalation. Isa had just crossed a line, and eventually it would bring him down. We move on from the crypto kingpin of Bel Air, finally, to the Rolling Stone essay. Taylor Swift made this year's biggest album and its most polarizing. The life of a showgirl inspired an intense reaction, and that's the point. Taylor Swift has long been obsessed with the showgirl's life ever since she was a kid. She was still an ingenue when she wrote Nothing New about her terror of turning age 22 and losing her audience. She always told stories about heroines whose experiences made up in America make them feel like performers in their everyday lives, and they can't tell where the show ends and the girl begins. She tells these stories all over in the excellent new The Life of a Showgirl, her sequins and glitter glamour rush of an album. To the surprise of not a soul on earth, it's blown up into the year's biggest album and the most polarizing. I've been afflicted by a terminal uniqueness, she sings in Eldest Daughter. I love that line because it's either the best or worst moment on the album, depending on your personal Swiftian chemistry. Something about Taylor will always trigger those love-or-hate gut reactions. But make no mistake, that's exactly how she wants it. As she says in her supporting album documentary, in my industry, attention is affection. That's the life of the showgirl, and it really is the only one that she knows. All over the album, Taylor sings about her romantic bliss with her new fiancé, Travis Kelce. She's due, right? After all those teardrops on her guitar over the years, all her isn't it, and I didn't those, it's righteous to hear her celebrate the power of true love in The Fate of Ophelia or Apollyte. Just two of the highlights here. But it also might give you whiplash, since she's a couple of years past the song where she snarled, I wouldn't marry me either. Last year, she dropped the Tortured Poets Department, or as she dubbed it, Female Rage, the musical. It was a season in hell that was also an exile in Guyville. Her diary is spending a few weeks under the thumb of a careless man, a hot English rock and roll leather boy, no less. But this year, she sees true love as shooting hoops in the driveway with a guy who gets run over by other men for a living. There's something so hilariously flippant about Taylor's mean streak these days. I absolutely love the moment when a BBC interviewer asked her if her marriage meant retirement, and she replied, "That's a shockingly offensive thing to say," then laughed, not a conciliatory, "just kidding." Laugh, a condescending, "Do you kiss your mother with that mouth?" Laugh. Her lack of piety was a joy to behold. She's slamming harder than ever against that 1950s shit they want from me, in case anybody thought this childless cat lady might tone down the female rage. The album centerpiece is Elizabeth Taylor, a love song to one of her longtime movie star obsessions, calling Liz one of the most ultimate quintessential showgirls. Only Taylor Swift would get engaged to the man of her dreams and then immediately celebrate with an ode to the movie queen who got married 8 times. The first time Liz's husband, Richard Burton, met her, he complained, she was in short too bloody much. But like La Liz, this Taylor was born too bloody much, and she'll never change that. Baby dolls, she couldn't if she tried. It's the showgirl in her. Tortured Poets was a defining statement for her, a mess even by her standards. She dreamed up a complex 31-part song cycle in her spare time in the middle of history's most lavish tour. The music was full of old detours and experiments, yet the pop audience adored its playful weirdness. It was like her White Album, a build-your-own Taylor kit, where she forced you to do the work of fitting it all together. That was part of the adventure. Well, that wraps up this edition of Rolling Stone. Next week, we have a special presentation, Rolling Stone's special edition, Mick Jagger and Keith Richardson and 60 Years of the Rolling Stone. Thank you for listening. This has been Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.